Good afternoon. I think we should get started. We're going to multitask, so if you're still eating, don't worry. You're going to be able to eat and listen. That's doable. I'm Wendy Thompson. I'm here at McGill, the director of the School of Social Work. One of my many titles, but that's the one I use today. Welcome to everyone to this lunchtime session. You can see that we're keen in this event to get everyone getting the maximum input possible. So lunch is interweaved with this rather interesting panel that you're going to have the opportunity to listen to. There's two people that we're speaking with today. The topic is the struggle against marginalization. I'm sure you know something that's interweaved with many of the other issues that you're talking about today. We've got two speakers who I'm going to introduce one after the other. The first is Grace Edward Galabusi. I can assure you I could go on for a long, long time with both of these speakers, but there are many achievements and the reasons that you're going to want to listen to them, but they both asked me not to. So I'll just say it'll be very brief and you can read there are many achievements in your document. So Grace Edward Galabusi is an associate professor in the Politics and Public Administration Department of Ryerson University here in Toronto. And he's a research associate at the Centre for Social Justice in Toronto. He's written many, authored many books. Amongst them is Canada's Economic Apartheid, The Social Exclusion of Racialized Groups in the New Century. And he's also co-authored a book on race and racialization in essential readings. Great to have Grace Edward with us. I'm looking forward to what he has to say. I'm going to suggest that you need to follow me here from Samia Bishara Reset. And I should have checked if I had to close. Okay, sorry. That's the best I can do. We're very pleased to have Samia with us. She's come a long way to join us. She manages the Queen Rania Family and Child Center at the Jordan River Foundation. It's a prevention project that falls under the umbrella of the Foundation's Child Safety Program. And the center provides comprehensive services to combat child abuse by developing awareness and education training programs in the fields of children's rights and safety, child development, and community development. Very exciting opportunity to have someone join us from such a long way, from such an incredibly interesting and poignant part of the world. So I'm going to invite both speakers to speak on the subject of marginalization, how to combat it, and then I'll come back and moderate some discussion and questions from the floor. So have your mind thinking while you're chewing and you're listening. I'm here that's going to be good for your brain, so you're going to have lots of opportunities to do that. So over to you.
Thanks a lot. So if I had enough time, I would talk about my own association with royalty. But probably not. Let me stick to the topic at hand. Thank you that I'm really enjoying the conference and making all those connections with a bunch of people here, as well as the issues that are being discussed and the important relevance of both the issues of and the work that's being done. My presentation really is going to sort of take off from the work that I do in the legal context. But in the first part, I talk a little more broadly about issues related to racial justice and racial equity. And then go on to talk more specifically about the Canadian context, give some examples and also talk a bit about some of the tools that we're using in the work that we're doing, and at least one example of a campaign that essentially is aimed at the issues of racial justice, racial equity. In Toronto, a campaign run by the Color Quality Campaign. Some of you may only have heard about it. So the first I wanted to start was to read a quote from a report by the UN Rapporteur on Minority Rights, which was released a few weeks ago from Canada. And in it, she said, and I quote, "Achieving a truly inclusive society requires constant vigilance. significant and persistent problems faced in the view of the community belonging to certain ethnic, religious, and linguistic minorities. Many of these, those consulted believe that the federal provincial and territorial governments have not adequately implemented the impressive legislative and policy frameworks that exist in Canada. They have failed to respond adequately to their problems and to devise meaningful and enforceable solutions, leaving them and their communities feeling discriminated against and neglected. So I think, to some extent, because we're talking, I am talking about Canada, and we're living in Canada, there is some truth there that needs to happen with regard to the experience of Canada, so that those who are from around the world have a context within which to understand some of the claims that we make in Congress, because there's a sense, internationally at least, that Canada is the good guy. Canada is the example to follow. We have a fairly comprehensive human rights legislative regime, and so we have solved the problems that other societies are struggling with. And so what the hell am I doing sitting here talking about human rights issues in relation to a minority that's in Canada? So I think the starting point really is looking at the historical experiences of exclusion that define Canada's relationship, particularly with Aboriginal peoples, but also its racialized minority. These are both material as well as discussive and explain why, despite the deployment of a range of legislative and state institutional instruments, social exclusion persists as a significant feature of the Aboriginal and racialized existence in Canadian society. The historical expressions were written into the DNA of Canadian society and the Canadian state, but were written out of the Canadian narrative. And so they do not exist in the public mind to provide us with the foundation for addressing what are other apparent human rights violations based on race. Instead, what we often have is a smug satisfaction when we compare ourselves to our neighbors south of the border, the United States. And this has been the case for much of our history. This is not really just something that is new. It's been the case for much of our history. A quote from Prime Minister Rupert Laurier in 1910, talking about immigration, says, "We see in the United States what great problems may arise from the presence of a race and able to become full members of the same social family as ourselves." Now, I don't want to simply take us back to the 1910s, because I think that in some ways would be imprecise. But the reality is that there's a continuity in terms of the experience of racialization in Canadian society that I think is responsible, that is not as clear and as visible for many who are involved in policy making. And so in some respects, I think part of the problem that we face in Canada is that the fact that there are these instruments, these very instruments that are supposed to address these issues, is responsible for a complex logic that leads to a denial of the prevalence of racism and racialization. And so that racism becomes rendered invisible, and so it's difficult to put on the agenda. Having said that, I think that it's important for us, and I'm appreciative of this opportunity for us to have a conversation. So I'm going to quickly talk about the race, the case that I think needs to make for racial justice, and quickly run through some definitions so that you know what I'm working with, the assumptions that I'm making, and then talk a bit about the gender profile in Canada and the implications of at least the imperative with regard to dealing with issues that are related to racial justice, economic exclusion particularly, and then I want to talk about some of the things that we're doing in the community, the use of certain instruments like the racial equity impact assessments and the use of racial equity report card, for instance. So the context within which I want to start is to suggest that at least from a popular imagination, the issue of equality in a very context has been addressed by the society and is reflected in the news. In fact, Justice Yakuti from the Supreme Court Justice, who by the way is doing some work for the federal government right now on the issue of Afghan detainees, some of you may recognize that as an issue of interest, has said essentially that we have privileged equality amongst the principles of human rights. And so there's a clear commitment to this notion of equality. And so that should reflect on our conversation about race and racial equality within that context. Second is that there are these various instruments that Canada has established from constitutional commitment to such expression as the multiculturalism and one ethnic, all of which really speak to some degree of commitment to racial equality. But on the other hand, there's a gap between the existence of those instruments and the commitment that is constructed and the reality on the ground. So I will make the argument that doing work on racial justice and ensuring racial equity would be part of the effort of actualizing all meeting those aspirations that are articulated in those instruments. Third is the issue of social cohesion and the need for us to learn to live more effectively together. Fourth is the business case, the economic sustainability argument, both from the point of view of who's young and who's older in terms of various communities within the Canadian context, as well as rejuvenation or continual resuscitation of our labor market. Fifth is the social inclusion, a concept, by the way, on the one hand, that has become increasingly used in policy context, but also in community. But a concept which, for those of us who are doing work on racial equity, means that we need to reimagine Canada. We need to reimagine Canada in such a way that all forms of difference are fully integrated in the project that is Canada. That we can't have a sort of standard represented by particular cultures and particular ethnicities and particular genders and particular abilities and sexuality, and then seek to incorporate all the others into that standard. It's a project that requires a reimagination of what Canada really stands for. So some people say Canada is already in the process of becoming. And that may be an important distinction between Canada and some other societies, which is important because it provides us the opportunity for us to continue to reimagine what Canada really is and ought to be. And the last, of course, is relates to that, who we really are and changes in terms of the ethnic makeup of Canada. So, by racial justice, what I'm really talking about is that we're representing a process of reversing the impact of racialization of particular groups in society. And yes, to talk about racial justice, you probably need to talk about racialization as a process that establishes a system of race-based privileges and disadvantages for collectives within society. Now, there's a whole debate, of course, about the issue of race, and so that's why race here is in the comments. But there's an acknowledgement that it acts as an organizing principle historically and in contemporary life in North America, certainly in Canada. And there's a whole set of racial outcomes and racial history that in some ways is racist. Oh, okay. So let me skip this. A concept that I think is really important that I probably should just touch on is this idea of structural racism. And here what we're talking about really is that we're talking about a historical establishment of a racial regime or racial regimes that in some ways lead to particular outcomes. Whether the actors intend for those outcomes or not, those outcomes become inevitable because they are expectations and assumptions and norms that essentially lead to those outcomes. Those outcomes tend to be largely at first for racialized groups. The other, so that is sort of on the structure side. On the everyday side, it's important to look at notions like colorblindness, or what do you call the colorblind racism. a set of sports sustained by those who play the division to what essentially rest neutral policies, and shift focus away from outcomes to intent. So that, and this is part of the process by which racialization and racism are rendered invisible, because people say, if we do not intend those outcomes, they cannot be legitimate. Right? And there has to be some other explanation for all the disparities. It cannot be that racialization and racism are responsible, because we do not intend outcomes. After we have a colorblind society where everyone is specifically. So I hope I understand this idea that if you are the one who raises the issue with regard to racism, then you are the one who is using the race card. Which of course causes any conversation about So obviously it's this notion that messages are saying that certain people understand the other society being upfront. Even knowing this, many of you would know, especially in urban centers, where there's a constant array of stigmatizing images that end up defining how people understand particular communities. That happens at least for regional people, happens for black people around issues of crime. Okay, so I won't have the time to go through this, but I think that the dominant narrative is one which exhorts European culture and civilization and infuriates or infantilizes given cultures of others. And that may have to do with our history, a history of colonization when it comes to Aboriginal people, a history of privileging the quote unquote two founding peoples, a history of genocide, but also a whole range of other events, Japanese internment, the various exclusions of Chinese when it came to immigration. There were three significant legislative actions related to the exclusion of the Chinese from 1883 to 1923. This Canada would have looked completely different if those had not happened. It would have been a completely different mixture of races and ethnicities. The Hindu woman's president here, I'm really talking about the fact that gender was employed in terms of imposing exclusions of immigration because of the sense that women are part of our community builders. So if you let them in work as temporary labor, it's fine. If the women come in, it becomes a problem because they create communities, right? And so there was a whole debate around this agenda that the Hindu women's question in the West. Okay, after the more recently there was an apology by the mayor of Halifax and the premier of Nova Scotia. Because of the raising of a historical black community called Aperture, because the city was expanding and decided that they were blind on the city, and so they decided to raise them. Anyway, so the work that we're doing, I have 2 minutes, the work we're doing largely is situated in this concept of anti-racism action. And it is really about recognizing that structural racism is a social relation on the one hand, and that racial equity really means that we have got to engage the power relations that are responsible for both asserting it but maintaining it. It means that we have to address issues of how those who are privileged have privilege at the expense of those who are disadvantaged. We make a connection between those two. It's gone beyond the sort of liberal rendering of the notion of human rights. And so, one thing we do is to use an anti-racism policy analysis in the same way that we were talking about gender-based analysis with regard to policies and programs. And so, looking at the ideological dimension, social structural dimension, participatory dimension, and the domain, and ask a whole bunch of questions as to how, in all those dimensions, policies and programs affect those communities. One of the things that I want to talk about is the extent to which Canada is changing significantly in terms of its makeup. Part of the reason why it's changing is because of an increase in migration from the south to Canada. Certain parts of the world who are immigrating in Canada come from racialized countries. The population of racialized communities now is about 16%. It will be about 33% by the year 2030, so 1 in 3 Canadians will be racialized. If you look at from census in 2009 to 2006, there was a growth of about 27% in that population, compared to a growth of about 5% for the rest of the population. And issues of social inclusion are increasingly important issues with regard to how we to live together. So let's keep on that and just say that from the economic position point of view, what we look at is racial income inequality, inequality in employment, unemployment and underemployment indicators, other forms of labor market participation, the ability or inability to convert human capital into comparable occupational status and an income, and higher levels of low income. And so I will have time to discuss all that. Strictly, there is this sort of racial inclusion of poverty that we are working with because of the disproportionality in terms of exposure to poverty amongst racialized groups vis-a-vis other communities. 3 to 1 in Canada. So, quickly, to wrap up, how can we systematically, as communities, and those who are interested in actualizing racial justice, how can we address these issues? I want to say a number of things. One is this, the need for the focus to be on structural and systemic inequality rather than personal prejudice and this notion of interpersonal racial context. Second is a focus on impact rather than intention. Third is the need to address inequality explicitly, but not exclusively. I think the previous panel, it was not in my focus of about intersectionality and the critical need for us to use an intersectional approach and range to dealing with even racial justice. Critical, because of course, people do not live just in one identity, they live with a range of identities. And so it's really important for us to do that, given that we're doing that very well. Propose equity and inclusion as a set of solutions. The goal and strategy is to empower stakeholders and to target institutional partners and making racial justice a priority in all the work that we're doing on social justice. So that it is not an add-on, so that it is not an afterthought, but it is a priority during the work that we're doing. Let me just quickly say, talk about topic one. Using racial equity impact assessments, right? Oh, so I'm out of time, but let me just say, using racial equity impact assessments is really important in terms of systematically documenting what the impacts are, and then being able, through a policy process, to identify potential action that can be taken to address them. It's an important tool. The last thing I want to say is that the Call of Poverty campaign, you know, Tariq, is doing what we refer to as racial equity report cards. What does that mean? Leading up to the municipal election or the provincial election, what we do is we ask a whole set of questions. Or we go to communities, don't have communities to start to both document and ask a whole set of questions around their impact in terms of policy and program, a number of policy and program areas. For instance, what measures were taken by elected municipal officials in the last 4 years to reduce racial disparities? So we do a sort of a record, and then we're able to use that in the campaign. We look at particular areas where, for instance, municipality has responsibilities to provide services, school programs, childcare, libraries, emergency services, policing, housing, those kinds of both programs and areas of policy that are very near to the people in the communities that we're talking about, so that it isn't just an abstract concept. It is a very real concept that is clearly manifest in what people are doing on a daily basis. If I have a lot of time, I'll explore much more of this, but thank you very much. I,